What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics. Activism and action.
There's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on. It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping. One place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my god.
But otherwise, positive vibes here from me. Gotta harness love for the revolution. But truly, what does it take to have love for others, the empathy? I want to plug a YouTube channel, Renegade Cut. He just did a video about David the Gnome. It wasn't about David the Gnome. It was an obscure cartoon, I guess, from the 90s. And he made a general point about how TV and movie producers like kind of lampooning themselves. Like if someone was raised on TV, that they usually come out horrible. But he makes a contention that those that were only raised by their parents alone, parents who maybe their main pieces of advice were stay out of trouble and do as I say, basically the rules of authority, does not teach empathy and does not help people make the world a better place than they left it. Staying out of trouble is a recipe for complicity, is a recipe for masses of people being okay or unaware that we have concentration camps in this country, and that many Democrats, even progressives, are okay with it, are okay with detention centers, as they are called, if, say, the migrants there have legal aid, are, you know, inspected, so that they're being taken well care of, but they're still being detained as families. And that is still immoral as a consequentialist, as someone who doesn't just look to virtues and abstract concepts for what is right and wrong, but a general sense of what are the consequences and how do we maximize human flourishing as well as the rest of life. So the topic this episode, the next 2 hours, this Three Left show, going in a different direction. As the intro may have suggested, although it is an intro I play usually, this show is actually about anarchy. The last 2 episodes, I talked ecology, I talked socialism and the left in general, and now this episode, anarchy, the three flags that make up the three lefts. That is the meaning of this show. As well as just covering topics that interest me. And what interests me is how to make these alternatives, radical alternatives, work. Main opposition, from a reasonable perspective, a good faith argument, is that these alternatives cannot scale up. They do not work for many people, or cannot work for most people. Usually some abstract reason like human nature, which is flexible, or that the system we have just simply trains us to be the opposite of what we would take, you know, to be, have a loving, fair society. Too much of our society is about competition, too much about not having empathy, discouraging empathy, keeping your head down, staying out of trouble. But staying out of trouble just makes you a bystander, in my opinion. Another statistic. Let's start with an opinion piece from Carne Ross. He is called the Independent Diplomat, former British diplomat, but now the director of a charity called the Independent Diplomat. Imagine, it's not even, you know, a society's in trouble when we can't even joke about how, like, let's say you have that mercenary who goes from town to town, or a soldier of fortune, a gun for hire, those kind of heroes, the Van Dams and whatever. But to have a joke of, like, say, someone who goes from town to town and solves problems with peace, love, kindness, and just generally being a swell guy, going down, you know, for a diplomat for hire, going into desperate villages and mediating their disputes, leaving things better than he left it. So this is a guy who had a career in as a diplomat for Britain and discovered that, as his opinion piece is called, politics as we know it should die and loving anarchy should prosper. Click on that. This was published May of this year. So I'll start reading. The current way of doing politics in our economic life on this earth is coming to an end, whether you like it or not. Climate emergency will require dramatic changes to the wasteful way we consume resources and the grotesquery of the 0.1%, cruising in private jets while the rest struggle with rent and debt cannot last. A peaceful, harmonious society requires that people are fairly treated. For now, there is no justice, no peace. The breakdown of consensus is painfully visible in the poisonous cloud of abuse and polarization on our misnamed social media. But this is not working. So what comes next? The far right, because it trades in bogus certainties and machismo, has a clearer plan. It is rising in America, Europe, the UK. It appears because it pretends to return control to those who feel shut out of the existing political system. Though, in fact, its only strategy is more authoritarianism, justified by whipped-up racism and fear of the other. The left and other Greens offer a more sympathetic proposition, but no political party can honestly claim to represent the people or even the many. It's true. At the very most, we're a niche that can grow to maybe encompass 30% of the population, give or take. When people take to the streets, the political system isn't working. In France, the Yellow Vests have been demonstrating for 7 months against a government indifferent to inequality and deaf to their voices. In Britain, the movement known as Extinction Rebellion has already altered the way we talk about climate. It is no longer change, but an emergency. But street movements cannot govern, and protest alone cannot change the basic model of our economy, governed by allegedly representative democracy. The fundamental structure, how we govern, and indeed our whole way of living together, needs to change. Scratching a cross in a box every 5 years does not feel anything like enough, or does showing up for a demonstration, or even signing a petition. Something more is needed. To create a truly just society, where everyone gets a fair crack, you need a politics where everyone gets the same opportunity. Representative democracy, as it's called, where the few govern the many, inherent advantages those who can access the system, or inherently advantages them. The already privileged, the rich, the corporate. Its party-dominated culture promotes simplistic and often infantile debate about complicated problems. Did you see the last Democratic primary debate? I did not watch them. I have better things to do with my time. And I also want to make a point about not calling it a debate. Here's my good argument here. So, cable news networks, they have panels of, say, likely voters or average Joe voters in their studio. And there'll be like 8 of them or so. And they'll ask them questions individually, ask them questions as a group. They'll have a lightning round. It'll be a group interview of sorts. That is what the quote-unquote Democratic debates have been. They're not debates. They're group interviews at best, and they're candidate forums at worst. They're not debates, because if they were, they would ask the same question to every candidate, give them 30 seconds to say something, and then do a bunch of lightning rounds where they each get like a sentence, you know, not just a yes or no, because that's too simplistic, but give them a sentence, you know, I guess that would be 30 seconds. And then a minute response for the larger questions. Because if you can't fit your answer in a minute, you're not concise enough. 3 minutes is a limit, okay, and that's kind of what they give Biden and then the front runners. They give them 3 minutes or something. And that leaves less time. For, you know, and the pattern with all of these quote-unquote debates is that if you are not the front runner, if you're not, if the network does not plan on asking you the most questions, you have to interrupt. You have to show how aggressive, aggro, and above the rules you are. You know, and if you do follow the rules, like say, oh, I'm out of time, as Biden did at one time, that's seen as weakness, and you shouldn't do that. You should always just keep talking. What a sham, right? Do you want people following these rules? Well, the rules suck, and they're inconsistent, and they're barely there. So, yeah, it's a mess, and it's hard to watch, and so I don't watch them. I do easy things. I like my life to be nice and pleasurable, and I don't like torturing myself. I don't do that. I'm not a masochist. No offense to masochists, to what they do in their own home. Moving on. The grown-up MPs are frustrated by it too, says Carney. Radical change seems totally out of reach. By grown-up, he means like the mature legislators who want to do more, but they're hamstrung by the structure of how the government works. The answer is anarchism. Yes. It's not the anarchism of Molotov cocktails and mass demonstrators, I've done that, but something that more resembles true democracy than the current travesty. Anarchists believe that no one should have power over anyone else, which is also nobly the only way that love can truly thrive. To achieve that, political decision-making needs to give an equal say to everyone. It sounds idealistic and is routinely denigrated as impractical by those who know nothing about it, but it can work. In an uncritical history of representative democracy, it's never mentioned that democracy in ancient Greece meant citizens, not career politicians, taking in turns to debate and take decisions, as long as you're a man and not a slave. Okay. But in Porto Alegre, a large city in Brazil, enjoyed 10 years of mass democracy where thousands of citizens debated budget priorities on things like schools, clinics, or sanitation. This is a process called participatory budgeting. The World Bank found that, as a result, the city enjoyed much more equal provision of public services, justice, and welfare. Traditional politics, in the form of the squalid contest of venal officials, disappeared. Whew, like magic. And yes, and to all those cynical old people who just hate politicians, and yes, politics overall are dumb, but they are important. This is a kind of direct participatory democracy, inspired by anarchist thinking, and is now thriving in Syria of all places. Outside of regime control, in the predominantly Kurdish northeast, local councils make the decisions. This is Rojava. This is the Kurdish alternative that I mentioned in a previous episode, rather 2 weeks ago, on air, and will be posted online in 2 weeks, I guess. Always co-chaired by women, anyone can attend, and they do, I've seen it, their decisions and then feed into regional assemblies composed of representatives of the local bodies when larger scale politics like a new road or taxation need discussion. But nothing can be decided that isn't approved in those on-the-ground communal councils in the neighborhoods. Their decisions are only administered at the larger scale, the very opposite of our top-down elective dictatorship. That is a Tory Lord Hentrim's term, not his. Mine, you know, the writer. Technology can help share information, though we need better ways to verify it. But the internet clearly is not a good place to take complicated decisions. Study evidence shows that people are much more likely to agree when they meet in person, and also agree more often. It makes sense. You may detest that shouty man who attacks teachers on Twitter. If only you knew him online. In person, you may feel differently when his eyes fill up over the treatment of his special needs child in the underfunded local school, or when the teacher gets to explain her reality. Real-life democracy requires a give and take, that my concession today might invite yours tomorrow. We respect and listen to each other more when we see each other as messy, lovable humans rather than reductive political labels. This is the beating heart of anarchist self-government, the struggle to understand, make decisions, and live with one another. But this is the beating heart of a civilized, fair, and tolerant, indeed loving society, too. Metamon philosopher, on a side note, has a book called The Listening Society, where he talks about how listening is kind of step one. You're listening to me, and I want to listen to other people. And I do. But how does this happen in a system which feels deeply entrenched, complacent in its self-regard as the mother of democracy? XR has already opened talks with Mayor of London and others to demand a citizens' assembly. XR is Extinction Rebellion. But it shouldn't be left to the whims of one man to grant the people democracy. The necessary change is much wider. It's about a whole culture of how we live together and perhaps start to love one another. We need to make it happen ourselves. It's totally possible to start meetings in a workplace or a local neighborhood. Well, if they include everyone, then they will start to gain legitimacy. It means learning new techniques to listen and give priority to these normally ignored. No one should pretend that this would be easy. I do not. But the decisions of these gatherings could start to feel like the only decisions that actually matter. Top-down impositions by bosses or politicians will offer a poor contrast. A system can shift without violence and by consent. It's long been presumed, not least by Marx, that the English would never revolt. I'm no longer sure that holds. When pensioners, schoolchildren, and professors block London streets, something is afoot. There is a sense of possibility, of flux and opportunity. A sense that new ideas can be imagined and brought to life very quickly. Building a new democracy and society requires us not only to demand it, but to do it ourselves. Connie Ross is a former British diplomat, author of a book called The Leaderless Revolution, How Ordinary People Can Change Politics and Take Power in the 21st Century. He's also the subject of a documentary film, Accidental Anarchist, produced by BBC4. Yes, there are many BBCs. He is director of Independent Diplomat, a charity that gives diplomatic advice to democratic movements and governments. You can follow him on Twitter as well, at Carney Ross, C-A-R-N-E Ross. Now, that was, I just left off with an introduction by a British diplomat. As he traveled around the world and engaged with people's movements, he decided that the way government works now, representative democracy, liberal democracy, it needs to evolve, it needs to grow into something more with more direct democracy. That is what anarchism is. Now for a piece from It's Going Down, Insurgent Proletarian Life. So this is a site that's dedicated to news of anarchist activism in America. They kind of see themselves, as many do, as kind of insurgents fighting a war against our system. Not a big gang, we're not killing people, and we do not threaten actual violence for the most part. Except some Nazi punching. And it has worked. The alt-right is in regression as far as their public meetings, or public, not meetings, I guess, but big showy speeches and college tours. They've all given up. They'll say the pressure's too great, Antifa has won, and is because of our aggressive/confrontational tactics. So now the movement itself, the movement for anarchism in America, is at a crossroads. This is the title, The Future of American Anarchism, by an anonymous contributor, of course. An analysis and critique of the present anarchist movement with some broad proposals heading into the future, while looking towards the continued economic breakdown and political polarization. Ooh, scary. Just wait till another recession hits. It will happen. It's been almost 15 years. It's usually an every 15-year kind of thing. The anarchist movement in the U.S. stands at a crossroads. Behind us lies a long history of successes and failures, the catalog of experiments that have brought us to where we are today. Popular movements have subsided for the moment, and most of us are regrouping and preparing for whatever lies ahead. In recent years, the debate has simmered about the kind of movement we want to build. On the one hand, we have a vision of a movement that is broadly the same as we inherited from the 1990s, a subculture, insular, and engaged in worthy but largely reactive projects that fail to build durable power. On the other, we have a vision of a movement yet to come, oriented towards the broad base of the oppressed, focused on organizing popular resistance, looking ahead to the looming possibility of revolutionary change. One of these visions presents a viable future for the movement. The other does not. The movement that we have inherited achieved many successes. The ecological, anti-capitalist, and anti-war struggles of the 90s and aughts were carried on by precisely the kind of movement this piece is critiquing. our comrades, largely organized in loosely knit affinity groups, as they were called, kept hope alive in an era of capitalism's seemingly complete triumph post-Cold War. Black bloc actions during mass demos ensured that we received media coverage, and the new people heard about our ideas. Mutual aid projects provided key services, like support for political prisoners, and helped to show the softer side of anarchism. By the time of the 08 financial crisis, anarchist ideas had spread enough to inspire the ethos of the Occupy movement, as well as myself, and its forms of organization. The anti-police uprisings from the Oscar Grant and Mike Brown protests onward likewise borrowed from our arsenal of tactics and ideas. These latter movements, Occupy and Black Lives Matter, demonstrated both the power of our ideas and the anarchist movement's limits. We were able to jam up business as usual and force the issue onto the national stage, like the injustices of capitalism, Occupy, or police terror, into national attention. We helped to demonstrate the power of decentralized combative action. When 2016 brought the renewed threat of street-level fascist organizing, we fought back. The anarchist movement did much of the heavy lifting in anti-fascist work, and we won a crushing victory in our first round against our new opponents, the alt-right. But while each movement radicalized new participants and left a scattering of small affinity groups across most cities, neither dramatically increased our strength or capacity to achieve our goals. So this critique will come as no surprise to the readers here. They have been repeated time and again by otherwise wiser people. But why haven't they grown in strength, even when we're successful? The movement has remained trapped in the circumstances from which it emerged. We still operate much too much like a subculture, focused on the visual and symbolic trappings of quote-unquote anarchism. The clothing, the stances, abstract as they are. In too many spaces, insularity and cliquishness are confused for security culture. You know, the ability to not get crushed by the cops, infiltrated by police, and so on. More broadly, the movement has focused too much on the opposite poles of direct action and aid programs, and too little on the concrete work of organizing itself. That is, deliberately reaching out to and bringing new people into the movement. Now more than ever, it is critical that we address these shortcomings. We are entering an era of intense polarization. The rise of a genuine ultranationalist and fascist threat, expressing itself within the Trump administration, as well as its support base. We're facing ecological catastrophe as well. Multiple indicators suggest that another recession is in the offering, roughly in the next year or so. Many more people, will be radicalized by this next recession and the coinciding electoral spectacle, and they will be looking for answers. If we do not reach these people, others will. In the best case, they will be reached by others preaching the dead-end roads of electoral reform, or distant and ill-defined revolution. In the worst case, they will turn to the fascists. We have to recognize the present historical moment for what it is, and behave accordingly. So what must be done? Well, we must make our movement an organizing one. I am not arguing for the triumph of one tendency or another. If we want to build towards insurrection, whatever that means, we must have as many comrades as possible, as many allies, who share our vision and skills. If we want to create a powerful federation, we must have a popular base to draw new members from. If we want to build syndicates, revolutionary or otherwise, we must have organized strong unions and spread consciousness in the broadening working class. Whatever tendency we hail from, the days of isolation and subcultures must end. How do we build an organizing movement? Simple question. Well, by focusing our energies primarily on organizing with a broad base of people for the struggles of our era. So what is that? And this is something that, you know, many other podcasts, they have organizers on, but they're so vague with the details. This hopefully gets a little... Let's see. Organizing is building a structure that increases the power of that structure's members and enables them to collectively fight for their goals. Where we are exploited by bosses, we must build unions, revolutionary ones, that, you know, seek to actually own the business eventually. Where we are robbed by the landlords, we must build radical tenant unions. When we are brutalized by the prison system and ICE, we must create networks of prisoners, migrants, and neighbors to resist the violence of the state. In each case, we must deliberately and consistently reach out to that to the unorganized, building relationships of trust with new participants, and create a capacity to resist where it was lacking. We must then link these organizations into a wider network capable of expanding that support of one another. This comes in the form of, say, paying for people's expenses when so they can go on strike, or even just take a day off. There are already some encouraging signs in this direction. Comrades across the country have organized in support of prison strikes, organized tenant unions. They've done outreach with inspiring mutual aid programs during disasters, and carried on the anti-fascist struggle. Networks like the, what's called the symbiosis, seem to be moving toward coordinating projects at the national level. But these efforts need to be significantly expanded if we are to meet the challenge that faces us. Our movement is uniquely positioned to succeed, if we choose to do so. We believe in the power of the oppressed. We do not waste our time canvassing for the next Syriza, like with the DSA. Our comrades are extraordinarily dedicated and prepared to make real sacrifices when necessary, referring to Antifa. The key is for our movement to channel this dedication that so often turns into infighting in a direction that will allow us to grow, spread our vision, and build power. But if we do not change the way we presently operate, we are left behind with less promising forces. So wherever you are, I encourage you to start the hard work of organizing against those who are oppressing your community. Go out and speak with neighbors, your co-workers, or those on the receiving end of the state's violence. Link up with other groups, get in touch with national orgs, and start your own group if necessary. There is much to be done and little time to waste. Now, so ends the end of that piece. I'm left with time in this section, so I will ramble about how this links up with the current situation in my locality, where there are many anarchists, a good number, that could be a real force, but they're not organized. There are attempts to, there are groups, but there is a level of toxicity that I find egregious. I think it's the poison there, the creation of a toxic culture, toxic personalities, and I'm not trying to oversimplify here, but there is always an individualism there, that even though the consciousness of these activists, these people who are friends and comrades, and I go to their parties, and I hang out, and we do food not bombs together, which is one of those mutual aid projects that are just very small, and we're not really able to grow. We could do outreach, but then we don't have the structure to really accommodate more members as much as we want to. We lack someone to manage volunteers, so thus, you know, as a group of volunteers, we can manage ourselves, self-direct, self-manage, but when it comes to managing others, that's a job. That takes a dedicated kind of, that's a part-time job. And some of us, most of us, we're too busy for that. We got our own work for wages, but also other activism. And it's hard to keep up with everything. I also want to speak to when, it sounds easy. It doesn't sound easy, probably, to most of us. Just go out and organize, meet your neighbors and whatever. There requires meta skills that need to be developed and practiced. It could start with looking in the mirror and asking yourself questions in a way that you're so comfortable with that then you can do it to people you don't know. You can also practice by asking people you do know, but maybe you don't talk about politics enough, or, you know, their work situation. And it is something that must be very natural. Says go out and talk to people. Well, it is very awkward to just bring up organizing a union to a coworker when you don't know anything about them or you don't know their position. So maybe it just kind of helps to ask, how are your feelings on this news story? You know, kind of like a water cooler talk. Like, hey, did you hear about the teacher strikes in West Virginia? Well, how you feel about that? Isn't that cool? wouldn't it be great if we did something like that here? I read that they did it over Facebook. You know, it didn't. They went outside their own unions and started their own thing. Or it can start with just building of consciousness itself, all right, not just the ideas, because then people don't buy it. I don't buy this whole organizing thing. I don't need to be a member of something. I'm fine on my own. Are you? Anytime they complain about something work-related, tell them. It's the system. There is forces at work that we need to fight. It doesn't get better unless we fight. Get into trouble. We can't stay out of trouble any longer, because right now, staying out of trouble is trouble. It is bad. It is bad for us. It is bad for the planet. It's bad for everyone to, quote-unquote, stay out of trouble. We can't stay out of trouble anymore. We are in trouble. Ecology. Mass extinction. There are millions of new climate refugees about to be made. Cape Town's out of water. Cape Town, South Africa. They're out of water, literally out of water. And I think they did this, had to do this a few years ago. They're towing an iceberg there just so people have water. Otherwise, they do not. They're out of water. They're just barely holding on as a government there. It's just the beginning, right? You think Trump is bad and we can go back to normalcy by electing Biden? Get real. You're not taking things seriously, are you? Well, I am, and taking things seriously means asking the hard questions. What would it take to actually have a fair society? And for me, that means more direct democracy. And I ran for mayor, rather I've run for office, which was simply made up of me doing this. Going door to door and asking people basic questions, as well as relaying some direct democracy ideas at them. And I got some good responses. I also got a lot of skepticism as well. People who are just, it's such an alien idea to actually make decisions with other people. Maybe they're more comfortable going to a public meeting where that decision is mediated by experts, which is totally fine. It's like a soft hierarchy if those experts can be held accountable and their decision-making is directed. They're simply relaying the possible decisions to a more larger amount of people. Others were more anti-democracy. They were fine with the setup they had, where they have a strong relationship with their council person. They can call them up and complain at them whenever they want, when they need something done. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine for you, but this district has 6,000 people in it. Do you think one council person can have a nice, cordial relationship with 6,000 people, then everyone's representative? No, you are represented, okay? And so there are people in the city, and likely in America, who feel that they are represented because they have the inside connection, because they, and everything is, relationships. So they have a good relationship. But it shouldn't have to rely on one person or a few people in their relationships, because then it just turns into clans and factions and the kind of dirty, winner-take-all politics that would just makes us all toxic, because eventually just becomes individualism at the end of the day, not thinking of everyone or a collective good, but simply what is good for my side, what is good for my block, what is good for me. Another short story here. This is from phys.org, a science news aggregator site. Go throw some science at you. In relation to anarchist organizing, or just organizing in general, a kind of what's required, kind of like what are some principles, the patterns, what's the form language, as I could call it, that we should use to build things so that we're not just starting from scratch every time. So here's something to keep in mind: social networks, group boundaries promote the spread of ideas, study finds. So this is written by Catherine Braley of the University of Pennsylvania. Social networks influence how ideas and beliefs can spread around a society. In this study, University of Pennsylvania's, go sports team, Damon Centurola shows that networks are very diffuse and make it hard for ideas. Networks that are very diffuse make it hard for ideas to catch on when it's just a big mass. But networks with very strong group boundaries make it almost impossible for ideas to spread. A network that was moderately grouped, however, was most conducive to spreading complex ideas. So I want to share radical ideas. What kind of group should I be going to? The ideas that are like cliques and they don't really want to listen to anyone outside the clique. They don't trust me. I'm not one of them. Or there's just the mass of unorganized, ungrouped people who are just milling about. And they're all kind of on the ocean, to use a metaphor. Probably a bad one. But mostly, like, they're just kind of not grounded by any kind of social group besides maybe a family. Maybe it's a church. But again, not in a strong boundary. Counterintuitively, he finds that breaking down group boundaries to increase the spread of knowledge across populations may ultimately result in a less effective knowledge sharing. Instead, his research shows that best practice and complex ideas are more readily integrated across populations if some degree of group boundaries are preserved. So there need to be some form of boundaries. But not too strong, like walls, and not too weak, where you just kind of have a big crowd of people and it just becomes a mob. The findings suggest that a policy to increase integration in a workplace by doing away with ethnically affiliated clubs, for example, could actually reduce the likelihood that ideas and beliefs would be shared across the company. The work has implications for institutional attempts to increase diversity, businesses' efforts to spread shared values, and organizations interested in integrating solutions to complex problems. That's quite a word salad there. Let's see if I can translate that. So you have these companies that are doing away with, kind of broke up clubs that became too insular, you know, subcultures, like the anarchist subcultures I just discussed. Got to break up those boundaries a bit. Centrella is an associate professor in Penn State's, or University of Penn, Annenberg School of Communication, as well as applied science, and is director of a network dynamics group at Penn. His work is published in the American Journal of Sociology. Nerd. The work builds off foundational research by social theorists Peter Blau and Joseph Schwartz. In 1984, they argued that societies in which group affiliations were eliminated would enjoy the greatest levels of social integration. A direct implication of their theory was that social policies that reduced group boundaries would create the most opportunities for complex ideas. In the current work, Centrella revisited these theories and used a new computational model, to understand how social affiliations create networks, and in turn, how complex ideas and shared practice can diffuse through those networks. The model assumed that each individual's personal and professional characteristics, e.g. their gender, race, religion, income, education, political party. Usually social sciences use the word income instead of like economic class, but income level is very important, as well as where they live, their residential neighborhood. These characteristics define the person's identity. The structure of a society is determined by the extent to which different characteristics are correlated with one another. For instance, if a person knows another's religion, income, and education, can he or she also predict the neighborhood where that person lives? That's very much the case. Also brings to mind knowing each other's income. It's been brought up in I guess, Twitter examples on social media. Instances where I talked to a coworker and discovered that they were making more than me, even though we do the same amount of work or I do more work. This knowledge, by actually talking about the issue of income, empowered me to go to the boss and demand a raise, as well as talk to others and say, we should all have more level income field. Why is this person being paid more for doing a similar, if we're being paid based on how much value we're producing for you, I should be paid more. Centrilla's experiments with the model showed that these correlations have striking implications for social networks that emerge. I know this probably seems very intuitive, like, oh yes, people group together based on their identity. But then how do we have kind of cross-pollination of ideas? The boundaries can't be too strong or too loose. But I think the thing that speak to me about this post here, this article, was that there need to be a certain level of boundary for ideas to spread. So it's not just a matter of removing boundaries. That creates a mob of people that can't be organized in any effective way. No organization, no governance, authoritarianism results, or some form of tyranny. Because then with a mob, the only way anything can get done is if one or a few people take charge. Not that it has to be that way, but that's how it usually shakes out. Let's see. The results are surprisingly clear, Centrilla said. The stronger these correlations are between identities, the more grouped the entire social network is. Small changes in the correlations between two characteristics, for instance, religion and residential neighborhood, have large consequences for the groupiness of the social network. The analysis also revealed a twist on Blau and Schwartz's work. As Blau and Schwartz predicted, reducing group boundaries increased the likelihood that complex ideas, like we need political change, could diffuse across a population, but only up to a point. Quote, when a society is too grouped, people do not have any social contact with people from other groups. People with the same job all attended the same school, live in the same neighborhood, and frequent the same clubs. Their networks do not expand beyond that group. Loosening these tight group boundaries means that people's next-door neighbors may have different jobs or levels of education, but they may still have similar politics or recreational activities. These similarities allow people in different social groups to encourage the adoption of new ideas. And take neighborhood recycling as an example, which can then spread to other neighborhoods and social groups. But when group boundaries are eliminated entirely, people have almost nothing in common with their neighbors, and therefore very little influence over one another, making it impossible to spread complex ideas. Okay, so there's the thesis of this argument, of this article that I really want to push, that as far as the market's concerned, it's just that's the quote-unquote chaos of putting people in neighborhoods based on nothing. It's like, oh, we want everyone. You know, it's a danger of saying we want everyone to be equal rather the same, as in we just want neighborhoods that are fully integrated with of class, religion, color, and then everything will shake out well. But then you have a neighborhood where no one has anything in common. And so there's no community. Only the only way people can relate to each other is maybe the kind of work they do. But even that is becoming more diffuse and less defined as careers melt away and work becomes precarious. There is no thing that one does anymore unless it is a hobby. And that is how, at least, you know, as far as social networks online and in person are concerned, it is generally hobby-based. And if your hobby is activism, that is that sub-community that then becomes insular because it then can have nothing in common with anything else. Because what do we have in common? Some of my other anarchist friends have full-time jobs. We are in different income brackets. They pay for their own health insurance. I do not. There's a belief that the more people interact with strangers, the more that new ideas and beliefs will spread, says Centrilla. What this study shows is that preserving group boundaries is actually necessary for complex ideas to become accepted across diverse populations. This is especially true for adopting new solutions to hard problems. In a business setting, for example, a new piece of information about a stock price might not require strong social reinforcement in order to spread. But a more nuanced idea, such as what is considered an acceptable way to conduct business, or how to respond to a new green initiative, green is in scare quotes, because when a business is doing it, it's greenwashing, it's not really solving the problem, can require strong social support to diffuse throughout a company. The success of a new initiative can depend upon group structures and can grow widespread support across a large organization. Centrilla further noted that these kinds of structures in which group boundaries exist but overlap to some degree, are naturally occurring on the internet. Distinct online communities sprout up among people with common interests, yet these groups also have interconnections across their membership. It could be that the internet is in fact set up and operates in such a way to allow easier coordination on complex ideas. So there's the end of that. Kind of wish it went on and went further with the ideas of that, which is totally fascinating. And obviously this does have implications. Like, you know, when you start a union, you're trying to organize people based on income bracket, one type of identity. But part of intersectionality as a principle, I'm probably just crashing ideas together at this point, is that people have different kinds of identities, right? There's not only where they live, there's their income bracket, their class, kind of work they do or can do. There's maybe disability, and there's color, of course, and there's sex and gender. Those are two different categories. And people can group based on one of those things or maybe a few of those things. Probably the more, so I think maybe the key is to group on some of these indicators, but not all of them. Then you become too insular. Or you group people on none of these at all, except maybe workplace. So everyone working at a supermarket for minimum wage is of a certain class distinction. But then there's just one thing in common, and that's not enough. There needs to be a few things in common if ideas are to spread between groups. I find that very interesting. And something to remember in your own lives. They constantly mention business and workplaces, you know, corporate workplaces as examples, because bureaucratic top-down structures is how all of these social scientists work in. It is the water they're in, and although many of them are aware of that, they still don't kind of get away from it. Reminder that word of mouth is the best thing you can do in your part in growing the show and a number of like-minded comrades and friends. You can leave a review on any podcast platform you may find it. If you go to a podcast platform of your choice and the show is not listed there, please tell me so I can rectify that. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. No other platforms, unfortunately, I suppose, but not Instagram. Just too much to manage. To support the show, and I'm live streaming right now on YouTube. That's just the Three Lefts Show. That is the channel. Don't put too much on up there, but what's there is there. To support the show more materially, visit the Patreon page, also the Three Lefts. Become a member there. All money donated or given and shared with me as a patron goes to outreach, printing more flyers, buying more Facebook ads, etc., etc. Links and a show archive of all previous episodes are currently found at 3lefts.news, just 3lefts.news, nothing else. That is the website where I put all my episodes.
I don't drive a car because they run on gas, but if I did, it'd run on biomass. I ride a bike or sometimes a skateboard, so fuck off all you drivers and your yummy hordes sitting all day in the traffic queues. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't eat meat, I just live on moldy chives or the donuts that I found in last week's dumpster dives. You people in that restaurant, I think you are so sad when you could have been eating bagels like the
Okay, welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. So anyway, this is the Three Left Show. Radical left-wing thinking, opinion and topics that interest me. This edition, this Saturday, I'm covering kind of anarchism, organizing, how can it work, how does it work when it occurs, and how to make it more than simply just a bunch of cliques and subcultures, as it is. Right now, politics is kind of in the form of subcultures. That's kind of what it means to be polarized, that you have a lot of groups that are doing their own thing and have very strong boundaries. There's kind of a bit of cross-pollination, but otherwise, there's just these strong group boundaries of, like, us and them. And overcoming it, I think, is about growing our consciousness to see what identities do matter, how they matter, and where, what identities do we have in common. Organizing along class, for example. Not that I'm a class reductionist, meaning that class is all that matters. Let's ignore trans issues, for example, but no, they do matter. And these are strong communities, or at least communities that matter. So now, let's take a look at Eon, which is a blog, I guess, or a site. And they had a story quite a while ago. I've had this in the bank. So this was written by Alexa Clay, a writer and researcher in pursuit of misfit subcultures. She is a co-author of The Misfit Economy, published in 2015. Her writing has appeared in Wired, The Guardian, Vice, and others. And the topic is, like startups, most intentional communities fail. Why is that? At 16, so let's just, I'll go through the kind of introductory paragraphs, and then I'll go one by one through all of the kind of examples and places that she talks about. At 16, Martin Winnebeck dropped out of school and left his home in the German city of Dresden to live full-time at Tamara, a 300-acre intentional community in the rolling hills of southwestern Portugal. Now, for the sake of it, I'll define what an intentional community is, which is simply when a group of people kind of form a cooperative, a collective, their, you know, hippie commune out in the, whether it is out in the rural area, or it could be a squatting in a building or buying a building in an urban area. Doing it together as a group, something I actually want to do, so this is very instructive for me. And maybe you, who want to create a community wherever you are. His mother and father, a doctor and professor of maths, were reluctant to let him go. It was quite a shock for them. Born in 1990, just a few months after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Winnekek came of age in a society in limbo. The atmosphere of the former GDR, that's German Democratic Republic, still clung to people. It was a culture that was so formal, so obligation-oriented, but it had no heart, no love. Winnebeck explained. At the same time, in Winnebeck's eyes, the capitalist alternative was creating a system of deep economic injustice, of winners and losers. Neither story encompassed a humanity he wanted to be a part of. Tamara offered an alternative. This place was founded by a psychoanalyst and sociologist, Dieter Dumm, in Germany in 78, and refounded in Portugal in 95. Tamara inspired to dissolve the trauma of human relationships. Quite a task. Drum, heavily influenced by Marxism and psychoanalysis, came to see material emancipation, you know, liberation, and interpersonal transformation, working on yourself, as part of the same project. Durham has been deeply disillusioned by communes where he'd spent time in the 60s and 70s. Old hippies have great experience. And which seemed to reproduce many of the same tyrannies that people were trying to escape. Egos, power struggles, envy, mistrust, fear, while practices of sexual freedom often engender jealousy and pain. In Durham's eyes, communes had failed to create a viable model for a new society. In Tamara, he had hoped to begin a social experiment that allowed for deep interpersonal healing. Communitarian experiments such as Tamara are nothing new, although its longevity, almost 40 years, is unusual. Generally, intentional communities fail at a rate slightly higher than that of most startups. Only a handful of communes, or communities, founded in the U.S. during the 19th century golden age of such, lasted beyond a century. Most folded in a matter of months. This golden age birthed more than 100 experimental communities. More than 100,000 members in total. According to historian Mark Holloway in Heavens on Earth, published in 1951, sought to differentiate themselves from society by creating ideal commonwealths. The latest surge in communitarian startups occurred in between the 1840s and then again in the 1890s, coinciding with periods of economic depression. Surprise, surprise. But it would be a mistake to see intentional communities merely as a knee-jerk response to hard times. In historic terms, again, you know, the ones started in the 60s by hippies, those weren't particularly hard times. In historic terms, a broader discontent with industrial society has led to people flocking to communes, utopias, spiritual settlements, the eco-villages, back-to-the-land style stuff, designed to create a sustainable lifestyle and a stronger relationship with nature. To communities founded with spiritual idealist visions, transforming human character. Of course, the cult label is never far behind. And a cult is basically just when a group becomes so insular, their boundaries so strong, that's when cult labels are not far away, and that's the danger of that. Many intentional communities have had to fight their own public relations battles in the wake of sensational publicity. But regardless of our suspicions, our appetite for communitarian living might even be evolutionarily hardwired. Some sociologists have gone as far as to suggest that we are maladapted to this modern society, that tribal forms of life are more viable. Theories of neo-tribalism suggest that instead of a mass society, you know, we're all a big mob of consumers, human nature is best suited to small, caring groups. The anthropologist Robin Dunbar, he'll come up later, humans can comfortably maintain no more than 150 stable relationships. From an evolutionary perspective, modern society itself might be an anomaly. Cultural critic Daniel Quinn writes in The Story of Bee, published in 96, for 3 million years the tribal life worked for us. It worked for people the way nests worked for birds, the way webs worked for spiders, the way burrows worked for moles. That doesn't make it lovable, it just makes it viable. Now, I'll point out that there is a problem with that kind of thinking. We transitioned away from tribal life probably because it was no longer working. It wasn't completely viable. Now, it is viable for those that still live a tribal, rather, hunter-gatherer way of life, but that is becoming untenable for climate change. So why do utopian communities also often fail? Interestingly, attrition rates for intentional communities are not all that different from many other types of human endeavors. So, for example, the failure rate for commercial startups is around 90%, and the longevity of most companies is dismal. Of the Fortune 500 companies listed in 55, over 88% of them are gone. Meanwhile, S&P companies with an average lifespan of just 15 years. Can we really expect more longevity from experimental communities? And if not, what can we learn from an audit of these experiments? What are the key factors that undermine them and lead them to succeed? Perhaps the irony is that many of the administrative and managerial forces that individuals are running away from in mainstream society are exactly the tools that would make intentional communities more resilient. That regardless of how much intentional communities with utopian aims seek to step to one side of worldly affairs, they succeed or fail based on the same pragmatic reasons, notably businesses and startups. For example, malarial-infested swamps, false prophecies, sexual politics, tyrannical founders, charismatic con men, lack of access to safe drinking water. Sometimes it's just poor soil quality. Maybe the labor is unskilled. Not the right skills. There's a restless dreamer syndrome, where, you know, you're just not satisfied with whatever you're doing. Land is not suitable for farming in the first place. These all sensationalize the rocky history of intentional communities. But the more relevant drivers that cause these communities to unravel sound more like the challenges of any organization. Capital constraints, not of money, on hand. A burnout, a conflict over private property and resource management. Poor systems of conflict mediation. Factionalism, founder problems, reputation management, skill shortages, and a failure to attract new talent or engage the next generation. And then it talks about Next paragraphs are about Robert Owen and New Harmony of 1825. This was kind of the first big one, because Robert Owen was already a rich man, so he had the money to go around and basically tell everybody about it and promote it, against the reality that it actually kind of wasn't actually viable, it wasn't sustainable. What was it? Population of 800. Only 140 were adept at working in local industry. Only 36 of them were skilled farmers. So you had a lot of joiners, but everyone wasn't learning the skills to actually produce. Community was far too open and indiscriminate in its invitation. It didn't have strong enough boundaries. Allowing anyone to join and attracting a lot of free riders without the necessary skills or the appetite for hard work. The absence of this, of its founder, didn't help. Owen lived in New Harmony only for a few months out of the year. No, out of its two-year existence. It was only around for 2 years. So talk about a dreamer. You know, many communities encounter this problem. Dreamers, drifters, and seekers in need of belonging. The needy, the wounded, the egomaniacal, and the power-thirsty are a dangerous constellation of actors for sustaining community. They usually don't. But often they are the most responsive to an invitation. Additionally, for many dreamers, the practicalities of farming and self-sufficiency clash with their utopian hopes for radically new ways of living, as people become pulled into the myopia of just getting by. Here, Catherine Blinder wrote in 04, reflecting on her 14 years in a Vermont commune. By going back to the land, we would not be bound by the strictures of society. We existed largely beyond the edges, beyond the rules. We were creating alternative life. But many of us generally believed we could make a difference, that we would stop the war and work for social justice while practicing guerrilla farming and modeling a collective existence. Blinder's days, however, were anything but experimental. Now, nobody works that hard as an experiment. She writes about her time cutting and baling hay, making butter, driving a tractor, cutting firewood, baking bread, and taking care of children. With too few people, you implode, but with more than 25 people, it is hard to create intimacy. It talks about, the next example is a Damahor, a spiritual and artistic eco-community in near Turin, Italy. Mariko Temeris, who left Japan as a famous jazz singer, went to live there. She says that the key to their success has been a very emphasis on practical devotion to work. We're not just a place for dreamers. While the community aspires to keep alive what she calls the divine spark in each of us, the structure of it has benefited from pragmatic organizational strategy. Damahur is a federation of communities made up of more than 600 full-time citizens, almost like its own municipality, primarily organized into small nucleos or makeshift families. The nucleos start as groups of 12. Now they number between 15 and 20. Scale is critical, she says, or cautions. If you have too few people, you implode because you don't have enough inputs. But if you have more than 25, it's very hard to create and keep connections close. The entire community is governed by a constitution that enables a so-called College of Justice, which upholds the values of their constitution. So they have their own pseudo-governance, as well as their own justice system. Not a law-enforcing system, but a value-enforcing system of justice, which many anarchist groups or just general organizations lack. There just seems to be an ignoring of it, especially, and it doesn't help when groups refuse to, say, use the legal system because we don't want to, and it's expensive to use the legal system to resolve disputes. That is why, as a local campaigner, I haven't made a campaign around it in particular, but I have a case to, that cities need to be providing mediators. Now, there is a nonprofit law project or legal project. You know, lawyers are obligated to spend a certain amount of their time doing charity work. Some of them, the good ones, do charity work in which they actually offer legal services for free to people. Now, I think it could be subsidized so that maybe you pay some kind of fee, but for mediation or to ask for legal advice, because there's too much abuse and conflicts that are just not solvable. Unless you have your own justice system where you actually have people who are dedicated to knowing rules that are set out by a group. A group actually has to set rules in some extent. And this is not counter to anarchism. It is part of it. The coming together and deciding on how you govern yourselves, that is anarchism. And I also want to draw a distinction between a hard hierarchy, the class hierarchies, and the soft hierarchies that are between individuals. So usually when anarchism or anarchy is brought up, people think it is a complete free-for-all, no hierarchy means no hierarchy. But the real definition is no unjust or unjustifiable hierarchies. And the kind of hierarchies you can justify are the soft ones. Parent and child, teacher and student, the kind of soft hierarchies between having to actually have a functioning government, delegates, and so on. To have a facilitator and the group is a soft hierarchy. But these people, in the soft hierarchy, it needs to be with consent. Consent's very important. Not only between individuals, but between groups. And that's something that our political system lacks in spades. Before becoming a full citizen of Dahomey, aspiring citizens go through a trial period and see if they truly feel aligned with the culture and intentions of that community. So they have a trial period, things that businesses have that, you know, make sure people actually work together. But even the best organizational acumen, intentional communities are often heavily criticized for the backwards progress they tend to symbolize. Bronson Alcott, father and author of Little Women, was characterized by the essayist Thomas Clark as a man bent on saving the world by returning to acorns. In 1843, this is a long time ago, Alcott founded Fruitlands, an experimental community in Harvard, Massachusetts, an agrarian commune influenced by transcendentalist thought and built on renouncing the civilized world. Think David Thoreau, who also lived in the area and lived during that time. Fruitlands abolished private property and cherished, yet struggled with self-sufficiently, refusing to hire external labor or depend on external trade. Attracting a little over a dozen people, Fruitlands failed after 7 months. Acorns, it seems, couldn't cut it. This is called the acorn problem, which persists today. Jimmy Slice, a young entrepreneur from Atlanta, is working to build a sustainable town from scratch in a river valley in Panama. When he showed his father, who was a traditional real estate investor, a mock-up of the town's infrastructure, his father remarked, "Congratulations on going back in time." He had only recreated civilization as it was 500 years ago, which then makes it a regressive project. Nara Paz, a Brazilian IT consultant turned eco-villager, lived for a time at the Findhorn Foundation in Scotland, one of the more successful intentional communities, running since 72, and is now a model of ecological building with solar and wind energy. Paris explained that it took Findhorn more than 2 decades to overcome its basic infrastructural challenges. In recent years, its income totals over £2 million. Though its expenditure is just £40,000 less, with more than 60% of the revenue coming from workshops and conferences, educating people, inviting tourists. That said, many people in Findhorn's eco-village still rely on the government for their living, and margins are tight. Everyone has food and housing, but there is no money for extras. Bottom line is, many intentional communities exist because of wealthy patrons and benefactors. Now, there is an intentional community in my neighborhood, Troy, neck of the wood, Tri-State area. They attempted to do this with kind of having rich people fund them. That didn't really last. They spent too much of their time just getting the funding and not starting the co-ops and being a co-op incubator that they set out to be. And again, it wasn't just the time on the fundraising. They just had interpersonal problems. It was a too small group, so there was some burnout. There's all these great projects, but they just don't seem to last, and I try to be part of them. And it creates quite a lot of unrest in me. That's why for this summer in 2019, I am looking to be more insular, find some inner peace first before kind of going out to campaign again. Next example is Freetown, Christiania in Denmark, created in the 70s as people took over an abandoned military barracks in Copenhagen as a place for a new society. So this was public land that was abandoned, so they started squatting on it. It became a thriving site for an underground economy, including a profitable trade in canvas, because it is right in the middle of town. The community also created its own currency, which doubles as a quiche souvenir sold to many tourists for money. Christiania is the fourth largest tourist attraction in Denmark's capital city, and receives more than 500,000 visitors a year. Picacanda, another spiritual community in Brazil, has also stayed financially healthy by catering to a market for spiritual voyeurs and wealthy elites who flock there to learn aura readings, breathing and meditation, conscious eating, dream interpretation, yoga, and even clowning. I like clowning, though. Point is that these communities rely on the external market, tourism, to make ends meet, so they're not self-sufficient. But that's not entirely a bad thing. This article doesn't put it as a detriment. I don't. There are a grouping of communes. They were just in the same area in Virginia because the land was so cheap that they were actually able to buy it. There's a bunch that kind of like they have a set business, like one makes hammocks or some kind of craft industry where it's a cooperative and they make something and then they sell it on Etsy or something like that or in the marketplace, and they make the income that way, either for property taxes or just to actually buy necessities. So they don't actually have to farm everything, make everything, and be home on the range and go back 500 years. We don't have to do that. Shouldn't have to. So all in all, the top revenue streams for intentional communities tend to be tourism, education. There's another one called crafts and artisanal goods and agriculture. As the historian Yaakov Orff have observed, 200 years of American communes, published in 87, in New Harmony, the only prosperous venture was the local hotel, where the many tourists and the curious came to see with their own eyes Robert Owen's famous social experiment were put up. In fact, Owen covered New Harmony's overall losses with a private fund. When he did make the balance sheet publicly available, community members were shocked at their illusion of self-sufficiency. Next example are the Shakers. One of the more successful communities in the U.S., numbered more than 6,000 in their mid-19th century height. Their success owed to a religious philosophy of hard work, honesty, and frugality, all Protestant work ethic values which do not serve us very well today, which made them good farmers and artisans. What great furniture. But ultimately, even with their artisanal viability, their practice of celibacy, procreation was forbidden to members who joined. This undermined their sustainability. Without human reproduction, the Shakers relied on active recruitment. And by the way, the reason why, not only was there a recession in the 1830s and 40s, but it was also with the beginnings of industrialization and the new republic, as it were, America, trying to find its identity. There was something of a religious revival, as well as a spreading out of all of these new sects. Some were cult-like, you know, the occurrence of evangelism. And all of these new different ways of practicing Christianity, Mormonism, for example, Pentecostals, and so on and so on. All of the American types of Christianity came about in this period. And the Shakers were just one manifestation of this. But with human reproduction outlawed within it, they had to rely on active recruitment. Celibacy, though, wasn't a very attractive proposition once people started thinking that the world wasn't coming to an end anymore. Today, the last Shaker village in Maine has a population of 2. In contrast, the Amish, whose families produce on average 5 children, number more than 300,000. Usually, the Amish practice of shunning has proved quite effective for retaining the young in the Amish lifestyle. Shunning excludes those who have transgressed community rules from commercial dealings and common social interactions. It's a way of creating a tight boundary around the community that maintains the culture, while threatening social suicide to members tempted to default from the church. So that tight boundary creating authoritarian practice. I don't like it. History shows that a lot of fundamentally religious 18th and 19th century social experiments in the U.S. were built on practices of self-denial, repression, and perfectionism that became exhausting for people to sustain, no matter the zeal of its members. William Penn's success with Philadelphia, the province, the future commonwealth, notably came once the city grew beyond the sober utopia of its founders' imagination. Just allowing people to drink, I guess. The question confounding nearly all of those seeking alternatives to mass society, says the dystopian novelist Margaret Atwood, sci-fi writer, what sort of happiness is on offer, and what is the price that we may pay to achieve it? The Puritan impulse towards the suppression of passion like Penn's insistence on sobriety was a high price to pay for belonging. But the loose sexual practices of secular communes of the 60s and 70s created immense jealousies and conflicts that just as readily caused many communities to implode. Most people, of course, flock to intentional communities to fulfill emotional needs, but the capacity of a community's relational skills are quickly tested by the personalities of its members. As Winnipeg explained to me about Tamara, if you go deep in the group, you can find all the light and shadows of humanity. This is a general point about how these intentional communities, even though they cite their goal is to kind of be separate from the rest of society to create a better one, they still are microcosms because the people joining come from the society. There really is no outside. Even when you're in an insular subculture, it's still America, if that makes sense. Just as these anarchists in their sub-community are still very individualist when it comes down to it. There's an egoism, and that is, in fact, a tendency of anarchism as well. That, like, it's just the conclusion that the best thing for you is to work with other people. But I see how there's some harm there. There's rivalry, there's conflict, it's not good. Meanwhile, at Damamar, conflicts are cleverly allowed to escalate into a playful battle that serves to exercise community tensions. So they have mock battles, similar to childhood play fighting. Teams equip themselves with white shirts and squirt guns filled with paint, and judges are used to determine whether a person is still in the game or has been defeated. Battles allow members to vent their warrior natures and access more of their shadow personalities, kind of get out that aggression, too often repressed by the soft statutes of civility to which we default. So, more play fighting, I'm for it. Mock battles. So, Damamores, that's the one in Italy, mock battles prevent a kind of burnout you find in most empathetic people in a community get tasked with dealing with emotional needs of others, putting a lot of strain on the shoulders of a few. In New Zealand, one freelancer collective in Wellington has found that another way of distributing emotional load, a system of emotional stewardship. So every member in a spiral community there, everyone has a steward, another person who checks in on them regularly, kind of buddy, listens to their emotional grievances, and holds them to commitments. So a best friend is probably someone who does that, but we don't have a best friend sometimes who does that for us. Although I do make an effort to check in on people I consider my friends. One of the main jobs of stewards of a culture is to be continuously weeding this beautiful garden. In practical terms, that means being really proactive about hosting conversations, calling out harmful behavior, call out culture to some extent, treating each other with compassion, though, and prioritizing relationships and feelings over process and being right. And thus you create better facts. Facts and feelings are not separate. Good communication, in turn, builds flexibility. As Tamaris from Damamar puts it, you should change things when they work, not when they don't work, when you have fuel. Otherwise, things get broken down that you don't have the energy. Compared with communities of the 18th and 19th centuries, this ability to pivot and change direction to not get locked in one path creates a greater resilience over time. It's another lesson more communities might learn from startup culture. When I asked a hummingbird elder about the key success in their community in New Mexico, he said, "It's about not getting undermined by one meme. Communities like startups need oxygen, not dictatorship. They need to trial innovation and reinvent themselves organically, an unfolding process, responding to the changing needs of members. An unfolding process is doing what is necessary at each step, absent of whatever of images." And the thing about, to point out about, say, the Democratic debate, go back to that for a second. The thing that upsets me the most and why I'll never watch it in full is it's just all image-based. It's the image of the candidates. It's the image of the policies. It's image, image, image. And images are illusions. They aren't real. They're just projections. And they bother us to some extent and keep us from fulfillment. Suffering is living to an image that just cannot be. So one must, and there's an image of certainty. When one tries to be certain, to have a plan, that is also an image. But one can impose structure as part of an unfolding process, living process. And that's something that the successful communities seem to have in common. So then the last topic is generational passing. So there are founder problems that are very tough and important at the start. The older culture building remains a thornier challenge. Building a new culture, you know, how do these, can these communities affect the greater, you know, mainstream culture? One of our ancestral utopias knew all too well. One aspect of that struggle is that business models for many intentional communities remain elusive or unformed. Self-sufficiency, for example, often means not taking advantage of economies of scale that can support a growing population. At the same time, many communities are chagrined to find themselves servicing voyeurs and tourists for needed cash, which brings mission drift to their organizations and a departure from their founding vision. That said, contemporary communities can benefit from the rise of freelancers and digital working, which reduces the agrarian burden and the pressure of self-sufficiency, allowing for more diverse revenue as communities contract with the outside world, meaning you interact with the market, but on your terms, hopefully the best of your terms. Amish e-retailers are one sign of this growing trend. So, final conclusion here. If today's communities offer escape from the cult of individualism only to end up being walled gardens for a privileged class of bohemians, entrepreneurs, or spiritual seekers, then perhaps for all their material success, they might yet be said to have failed. Yet today's collaborative experiments will create tentacles into more diverse populations or tackle agendas of social justice and economic equality, which remain to be seen. Perhaps the most useful construct than intentional community is the idea of shadow culture, defined by Taylor as a vast, unorganized array of discrete individuals who live and think different from the mainstream, but who participate in its daily activities. Shadow cultures have the potential to hold distinct values, but also use the infrastructure and opportunities of mass society. In many ways, then, utopias are only ever tightly glued pockets of shadow culture that mistakenly parade themselves as isolated entities. Another way of talking about that, or expanding that to how we actually act and work as activists or just people in America, is to expand shadow culture, to not just be in isolated pockets, but to be a subculture that, in fact, is platformed by the general culture. Whenever we appear on TV, or to have an alternative person appear as a represented character in TV shows or something like that. You'll never see a real practical anarchist in a sitcom, let's say. Or rather, maybe a sitcom about anarchists. There was a movie, a clip that I used, which was like a clip about anarchists, but like it was, the conflict was about a guy who just wanted some emotional community. And his conflict with basically like the burned shit down criminal person who kind of like much more toxic. Like if you really want to be an anarchist, you got to be burning shit down. Why am I swearing? So, yes. Okay, great. And now to one that actually gets straight to the point of what the theme I'm making here. So this is from a blog called Anarchist Writers. Making Anarchist Organizations Work, Dunbar's Number, Administration, and Care is the name. Written by Andrew and Flood? Whatever, and Andrew. There's a strong tendency, almost a rule, that anarchist groups tend to fall apart once they have more than 20 to 30 members in any city, or 50 to 60 overall. Or at the very least, an organization that once felt like it worked very well becomes one that feels sluggish and starts requiring too much effort to achieve limited results. There are exceptions, which means that this is not inevitable, but why does this happen, and more importantly, how can we avoid it in our organizing? The cause may be simply a limitation of our brains, and a particular number of complex interrelationships people we can track. And more correctly, a failure to acknowledge this limit means that informality will fail and formal administration is more and more necessary as a group size rises. A lesson that is not just relevant to anarchists, but to all attempts at horizontal organization. Organizing that is not vertical, with bosses and committees that make all the decisions. So he goes through kind of all the different combinations and personal relationships you have to maintain, even between three people, has many, many fast combinations. And basically, if you know some basic algebra, he kind of uses the example of a computational formula. And then actually talks about, I mentioned Dunbar before in the last article, but now here's a deeper version of Dunbar's theories. So beyond a crude illustrative sketch, it turns out that there has been a scientific study of this complexity of interpersonal relationships. In particular, a British anthropologist, an evolutionary psychologist, who is a specialist in primate behavior called Robin Dunbar, who has written a good deal about this. As often happens with science, the number he suggests is a maximum size for a group is referred to as Dunbar's number. It's close to 150, but actually it's like 148. A lot of recent interest in Dunbar's number comes about because of social networking. While I've written in the past about the benefits of organizing of the network effect, there, where as the network becomes larger, the benefit of the network becomes larger still. Dunbar's number represents the cost side of that benefit. The transaction cost of communication rises with the number of people. The odds are that the number of, and not cost in dollars, but like time and emotional labor and energy. The odds of the number of Facebook friends you have is some multiple of Dunbar's number, unless you are one of those people who do an annual cull. So Dunbar's number, so like, basic way of describing it is that, like, you have your close friends, your kin, you're actually like family. Roughly five people. Say a nuclear unit, you know, partner, a few children, that's your close-knit group. And so, like, even if you have a best friend, maybe that extends it to six or it's five. You know, let's say you have two kids and then you can have one best friend. You really can't handle more. But you can handle having a 15 to 20 person group that's your super family. These are your friends and other sort of intimate relationships. You know a bit about, you know quite a lot about them. You can, you're comfortable around them. You can go out and hang out. Then there's the 45 to 50 number group, which are your acquaintances. This can be defined as your clan. It could be like a subculture you're a part of. It could be your community. But actually, community refers to that Dunbar's number, which is close to 150. So this is your tribe, also known as your familiars. People you're familiar with, people you know, even if you don't know them, but you're at least comfortable, you know who they are. You trust them to some extent. You know they're not going to stab you in the back. They're not an other. So there are these rings of kind of a hierarchy. So when you're working in a collective, you know that like those people are your family. So like when you're working in a collective, like it going above five is difficult. But and you can have a super family of friends, and that's like 20 people. But once you go beyond that, then everyone else is just an acquaintance then. Now, in our modern society, cities especially, we come into contact with a lot of people. At the level of an individual, we can see in most circumstances in modern society that we are in contact with very much more than 150 people. When you catch a plane in an airport, you are seeing far more people in that space of time than any human would have seen in their entire lifetime for almost all of time humans have been on this planet. It's only in the last 15,000 years that we have started to congregate in larger numbers, although before that date there may have been an occasional super gathering, like a music festival. I'm going to use the concept of Dunbar's group in most of the rest of this piece to suggest the group of people we construct with whom we seek to maintain stable social relationships. That is the group of people where we maintain relationships in which we know who each person is, but also how each person in the group relates to every other person. You know, Johnny and Mary are dating. Of course, we probably don't think about it that way. Rather, we have those lists of people we might ask to a party we are holding, or that we go for a pint after work. Importantly for this essay, when we try to do intense outgoing political activity with, we need to know not only how they get on with us, but also how they get on with each other. Most of us don't consciously add and subtract people from the group, but if we look back a few years, it's easy to identify people we have had, in fact, added, and others we have mostly lost contact with. Dunbar's number is based on the relations in that single group, where everyone knew each other. That's an assumption that seldom exists in modern life, where instead, each of us has relationships with multiple groups, but those groups may have little or lot of contact with each other. The point, again, being not to get hung up on the exact number, but to understand that there are these limits. In physical space, city dwellers are continually not putting people in their individual Dunbar group. I stop off on my way to work at a Lindy every Monday morning. This is a standard British coffee shop. There is only ever one checkout in operation, and 90% of the time over the last 2 years, the same woman is working it. We say hi in recognition, but I know nothing about her at all. I have certainly no idea how she relates to the hundreds and thousands of other customers who must come in regularly, and I have no relationship with any of them. If management told her to build a personal relationship with her customers, that would be impossible. That we know nothing about each other is not because either of us is bad, uncaring, or because it's impossible to communicate, but it is impossible to communicate on that level with everyone we meet in our day-to-day lives. Politicians employ people whose sole job it is to track who they are going to be meeting and remind them of their name and some basic facts about them. I've talked to union organizers who try to retain at least one key fact about each member they're trying to organize. They try to identify and remember what that person's primary issue is. Try, in other words, to create a false sense of having that person in your Dunbar's group because they're more likely to trust you. Finally, this tracking ability is a talent that some people are probably going to be better at than others. It's not unusual for the sort of people who are attracted to small political groups to be quite introspective. In terms of organization, that can shape the way the organization appears to outsiders and how easy it is to engage with. How insular it is. How much of it is a clique? He's basically describing cliques. So now a word about the state. So usually how a state works, in historically speaking, is that, you know, a king and their Dunbar group, their ministers, their advisors, the court, they would act as the person or the Dunbar group that then handles the social relationships for the entire country. Military formations are also based around a Dunbar group, but the state and these relationships are enforced with brutality. So he talks about his own experience with a worker solidarity movement in Ireland. Speaking as the author here, when I first became an anarchist, the first organizations I was involved in were tiny. The anarcho-communist group was 5 students in the same college engaged in a militant period of student struggle. 4 of the 5 of us were also traveled to London together to squat and organize around the poll tax. We were from Ireland, and we also took part in various anti-imperialist solidarity demos, demanding the withdrawal of British troops from Northern Ireland. We didn't have much in the way of a formal way of maintaining group stability, but then we were also living in constant close proximity, facing hostile external enemies, so cohesion was easy to maintain. We were also at a group size that Dunbar suggests would have the strongest relationships. Then he was part of a member of a larger group that was initially 10 to 15 people, which was more or less the size of a second strongest relationship group. We spent a lot of time socializing together. In Ireland, social grooming operates around pubs and parties. For the first time, I was part of an anarchist group that did have formal collective methods like minute-taking, chairing, but we were a close-knit bunch, so these were add-ons rather than requirements. Okay, so if it's a group of people who aren't friends and who aren't always going to the pub for a pint, then these are necessities. Minute-taking, having facilitation, having structure. Over the following 20 years, as this group grew, it peaked at about 65 formal members, so entering the weakest relationship group, Dunbar suggests. It hit problems that at this time were hard to understand. For instance, members would have fallings out that seemed to be based around misunderstandings. or some members would develop very strong grudges against others, often based around the idea that the other person was not pulling their weight. Sometimes I knew there was little accuracy to those feelings. I remember in particular being at the receiving end of a heated drunken rant about the supposed laziness of one member in circumstances where I knew the actual problem was the ranter was simply unaware of the activity the person was doing. But that sort of stuff bred demoralization on the one hand and undermined commitment on the other. Over time, it proved very corrosive indeed. Retrospectively, I think the problem was that we had reached the size where people were exceeding the Dunbar's number limitation. Being in an active revolutionary group organization subject to time of considerable pressure requires a lot of collective feeling and trust, and the social grooming of pints after a meeting in the pub was only sufficient for a smaller number of people. People have families, flatmates, friends, and colleagues who must absorb a lot of their Dunbar's number. By the time we reach 30 or 50 members, we have crossed the line, and trust between everyone in a group was probably impossible to build informally. Dunbar has pointed out that the 50 is the typical overnight camp size among traditional hunter-gatherers like the Australian Aboriginals or the Sand Bushmen of Southern Africa, which isn't far off the level I think I started noticing problems. So then it talks about care. Relating to care, it's mostly gendered, meaning women do most of the caring and emotional labor. People look for individual care when the solution is collective, meaning it needs to be kind of administered. Individual people usually become the problem in this sense. So it becomes toxic to individualize the problem. Say, this person isn't pulling their weight, when really the problem is a collective problem that we are just too big and we need to either break up and still be connected as a federation of groups, or rather group within a group. That way we're in affinity groups and we all recognize that we're all doing the work. But then we can keep track of all the relationships within our group of 5 to 10. So he lists a number of ways of escaping the Dunbar number. For anarchists, we need to overcome. So I started this show talking about the need to organize to get beyond the subculture and the cliques that radical groups have. So here are some basic solutions here that he points out. Ideology is one. Mass societies develop... Actually, wait, how's it done? Right, so mass society usually keeps people together with ideology. The myths of Americana, the kind of common lies that our media tells us is ideology. A general form of common sense of a subculture, the way things are. But it's ideology all the same. They are developed from the top down in the interest of those who have wealth and power. That is the way it is in our society. In the USA, for instance, the American dream, now expressed through the ideology of neoliberalism, is a common point of departure for many. If you work hard, you get ahead is something strongly believed by many people who have worked hard and are still stuck where they are. Religion is also a unifying ideology of a group. It's a powerful glue for holding mass organizations and indeed other whole societies together. So those who argue that organizational problems must have political solutions are not entirely wrong. The construction of a better ideological glue can overcome communication problems, at least for a while. But using ideology as your primary glue to hold people together comes at a cost. This is something that is generally felt. Chief among those is the promotion of an unchanging conservatism. Since to enter into a free discussion softens the glue, and while political solutions might alleviate these symptoms, they may not in fact address the cause. Right? You have a line and you have to follow it. Everyone has to agree on something, so something has to be taken as a given. You can't question it, and thus you don't really have free thought. And eventually it becomes dogma. Ideology also has a major advantage, though, of being easy to reproduce faithfully and transmit over time and space. It scales very easily and doesn't necessarily require a large group to produce. Indeed, in the networked age of social communication, one person can create and transmit ideology as never before. And that's meme culture. Okay, I'm almost out of time. So the other two things, let's go quickly. Name drop is that these horizontal organization needs. So that is not hierarchy. So it is not continuing oppression. Is common transparent membership expectations. And then the other thing is to have an administration. Many anarchists tend to avoid administrative work. This is surprising as it is routine. Often boring, there's a little glory attached to it. But it is very much necessary to have a soft hierarchy. Yeah. Oh, you know what? I actually didn't go this far when I was reading through it. Number four is rules and standard operating procedures. So this can relate to code of conduct for managing sexual and gender, you know, things like, so when conservatives complain, like, no one knows the rules, this call-out culture is calling people out on a set of rules that nobody knows. The answer is for every workplace and every organization to form their own code of conduct to say, this is okay, this is not okay. So if you're going to do something, okay, it's okay, we'll review the harassment or the bad or the uncomfortable touching. And if it is, from one point of view, then that is in line with our code of conduct. Twitter and social media have codes of conduct, and that is how they root out fascists, but also leftists. So it cuts both ways, but at least they have rules they decided on, not democratically, and that's the problem. So those are some things. Something we'll revisit in future times with other articles, because this is good stuff here. So, but I encourage you to read it yourself, going past Dunbar's number, making anarchist organizations work. So come for a circle, hopefully, and now it's time to wrap up the show. Outro. My profound thanks for listening. We need to be a listening society, and listening is an important skill, often as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, other ideas that you may have, and other stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. I can be reached on social media, Facebook page, and Twitter, 3LeftShow. Capitalism doesn't believe in work like mine, or worth paying a wage for, so please go to the Patreon page and support me materially so I can afford outreach. That's Facebook ads and flyering. And the most important thing is to put these ideas and concepts that have been talked about into practice for yourself, or to think about how you can apply them to your life. So until next time, stay radical and keep going left. This has been the 3LeftShow with your host, Dan Platt.
This country ain't nothing but a company's dream. A couple hundred million workers, it's all that they see. Our hands in the tools, money writing the rules. From the sweatshop prisons to the cops in the schools. Got the middle class living like it's gonna last. Working longer, harder hours for less and less cash. Got the media spins, Republicrat twins. Got the war profiteer for great executive grins. Got the heroin running through the veins of the poor. Got the ghettos locked down, paying blood for the war. Got the cities decay, the dealers to pay, and the death squads working for the CIA. You got a million new jobs, 1,000 new jails, outsourcing the unions, profit tipping the scales. Got a brainwashed youth, a trumped up truth. Got snipers armed with rifles on the factory roof. You got a 30-minute speech full of oohs and ahs. Got the cops aren't tough, out there breaking the laws. Got a front row seat to your own defeat. You got the tear gas canisters filling the street. You got the laws all written for the rich and the white. Trick the rest of them fools into the army to fight. In a dead-end game, each war the same. You got a land and a people and a market to claim. Got a woman beaten down everywhere that you look. In the schools, in the jails, in the courts, in the books. Got the TV set, sexism's outlet. Got a culture full of men, talk of all for that shit. Yeah, and I do too, I'm not blaming you. But I'm trying to unlearn what they said was true. Yeah, and I need help, I'm not afraid to say it. It's a subliminal tool, sometimes it's hard to see it. Job in the office, you got your own room. You got the pen and the paper and the drive to consume. Got the suit pressed in, got the myth that you'll win, and the race to replace true ambition. You're gonna move up the ladder at the company speed. Gotta learn to dance quick to the company's greed. Gotta justify every step that you can with your eyes closed tight and your head in the sand. You gotta fight the desire to fight the police. You gotta fight your heart and your every belief. You gotta trust the leader, whatever he says, with the flag held high. Yeah, you're already dead. You already gave up. If you took their advice, if you play their game, you paid their price and you're gone, gone, gone. Yeah, there's no coming back till you realize your potential. Raise your fist in the air. See, if we look to each other and ourselves and ignore the phony remedies they stock on the shelves, we can undermine the greed on which the system depends and hope to build a new world based on lovers and friends. We gotta build from the bottom what we want at the top. We gotta work together if we want this to stop. From the fake grassroots to the top of the tree, I aim for peace and justice and anarchy. I want peace and justice and anarchy. I want peace and justice and anarchy. I want peace and justice and anarchy.